Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop. And today's program is called New Perspectives in Immuno-Oncology in the Treatment of Lung Cancer. And as one of our speakers said just before the call, this is a new topic for us to be offering, actually, and we're very excited about this topic, and we know that you're interested to learn more about this as well. It's a new type of treatment for lung cancer and always of interest, of course. This is part one of a two-part series on lung cancer and immuno-oncology. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and also many other lung cancer organizations. And it really is because of our collaboration and your interest in this topic that we have so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 656 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Korea, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's really a credit to all of you that you're spending the next hour with us and that, indeed, this is a bit of a global call. You're actually from all over the world on this call. Today's program was made possible by Bristol-Myers Squibb, a contribution from Lilly, and supported by a grant from Genentech and Astellas US LLC. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program and also for their corporate collaboration and partnership in making this program possible and this entire series possible as well. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Matthew Hellman. And Dr. Hellman is Assistant Attending Physician, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Hellman is going to address an overview of immuno-oncology, what it is and how it works, the types of immunotherapy, and harnessing the immune system in treating lung cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Hellman.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the introduction, and thank you all for joining. It's a tremendous testament both to the field that's ongoing as well as to you all that you've taken the time to invest in understanding sort of what this is about and try and work along with us to try and better understand how best to use these sorts of therapies for patients like perhaps yourself and your loved one. We often do see patients to talk about immunotherapy because it's new and somewhat different from the way that patients have typically thought about cancer care. And I thought it would be useful to sort of talk about the general concept of what is the immune system, what is immunotherapy, and how did we ever get to this point. So that's sort of what I had in mind. And it sounds like there'll be good opportunity for questions afterwards. If there are things that I say that don't quite make sense, but hopefully this is a reasonable starting point. The sort of fundamental concept that we're working with is that your own body's immune system can be used as a weapon against cancer. And to take even a further step back is to talk about what is the immune system at all. I think patients often don't have a good sense of what their immune system is, and that's a good thing, because what your immune system is this part of your body that is constantly working to try and keep you healthy. It's the part of your body that is constantly surveilling your blood or other areas for potential infections like bacteria and viruses, and is used to fight those things off, potentially even before you get sick. And that's the whole concept behind things like the flu vaccine that you get each year, is that by exposing your body's immune system to things that look like the flu, if you were to ever get infected with the flu during the rest of that year, that knowledge that your immune system then has the potential to protect you and eradicate the flu before it ever matters to you. Your body's immune system then is your body's police force against things that shouldn't be there, like viruses and bacteria. But we think, and I think increasingly there's good evidence to support that this hypothesis is true, that your body's immune system also can matter when thinking about cancer. It may be that just like the flu vaccine protects you from the flu, it may be that your body's immune system is constantly deleting cancer cells before they ever matter, and that there may be parts of those cancer cells that the immune system matters, that the immune system recognizes as something that shouldn't be there, something that's foreign or something that's dangerous, and deletes it before it matters. But ultimately, for patients that do have cancer that's growing or spreading, it's a sign of at least of one of two things. One is that the immune system isn't doing its job anymore, that it's not protecting you the way that it may have before, or that the cancer has found some way of navigating around the immune system, found some way to sort of counteract the effects of your immune system in protecting you. And that's where the whole concept of immunotherapy comes in, is that are there ways that we can use medicines to try and either retrain or to re-stimulate your own body's immune system to fight your cancer? And at least one way in which the idea of immunotherapy is somewhat different from typical treatments for cancer is that immunotherapy is really trying to use your own body as the treatment against cancer. It's an indirect treatment. The treatment is against the body, and then your body can become the weapon against your cancer. And that's the best case scenario, as it's leveraging this huge weapon that is so good at usually keeping you safe from infections and potentially cancers, but also has the ability to fight cancers once they're there. The idea of being able to use your immune system as a weapon against cancer is not a new one, although it's been a recently popular one. It was more than a century ago that physicians first realized that sometimes when patients had an overwhelming infection, that patients who also had cancer at the same time, that cancer happened to go away. That the idea was that you happen to get sick, so you happen to get the flu, and that one result of that, as you recovered from the flu, is that the cancer started to melt away. And that sort of initial experience gave a clue that something about the immune system and its response to infections could also be used to treat cancers. Starting with that observation, initially doctors had tried to give patients infections as a means to try and treat their cancer, which, as you can imagine, didn't work that well. Some patients, unfortunately, died from the infections that were given to them. But this was the beginning, this was the origin of the idea of using immunotherapy as a means of treating cancer. So fast forward about 100 years, it's been relatively recently that we've found medicines that can safely interact with your own body's immune system to try and better treat your cancer. And this initially largely started in a skin cancer called melanoma, where medicines that target some of your body's immune system cells that are called T cells, were found to actually substantially reduce and shrink and potentially eradicate cancer spots. And many of the medicines that are in development now work on these cells in your immune system called T cells. And T cells, as part of your own normal body, require having both a brake and an accelerator in order to be able to keep you safe. If you ever have had things like strep throat, you may remember when your lymph nodes got really big and painful as your body's immune system ramped up to try and fight away that virus. And you need an accelerator in order to stamp out infections or potentially cancers when they occur. But you also need a brake to keep things in check. You need a brake to keep things in check so that after an infection's gone, you don't continue to have this rapid immune response, that it goes back to normal. And you also need a brake in order to protect your body from your immune system going haywire and attacking your own body. You may know people who have things like autoimmune diseases, like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, or Crohn's disease. And these are all diseases where people's immune system is attacking their own body. And some of the purpose of having a brake on your immune system is to prevent you from having these sorts of diseases. But the concept of the brake and the accelerator have been the linchpin, the real sort of turning point in developing medicines that can be used to attack your immune system. And some of the most prominent ones then work by trying to take away the brakes of your body's T cells. And that by taking away the brakes, your immune system can respond yet again, hopefully, to your cancer. And it's this finely tuned balance between the brake and the accelerator that we are now using to develop medicines that can work. And it was initially in melanoma where this was effective. And I think, as you've probably heard, and then prompting so many of you to join us today, there have been tremendously promising results in patients with lung cancer as well. So that's sort of the idea of immunotherapy, where it's come from, and sort of an overview of your own body's immune system. I think that's probably a reasonable place to stop and maybe turn it over to Scott.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Dr. Hellman. That was really excellent and really very informative and helped everyone to kind of understand a bit about how immuno-oncology works. So thank you for that very clear-spoken presentation. Thank you. And our next presenter is Dr. Scott Gettinger. Dr. Gettinger is Associate Professor of Medicine, Yale School of Medicine, Thoracic Oncology Program, Developmental Therapeutics, Smilow Cancer Hospital, Yale, New Haven. Dr. Gettinger is going to address the difference between immuno-oncology and chemotherapy, immuno-oncology alone or in combination therapy for lung cancer, and examples of immuno-oncology in lung cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Gettinger.
Thank you, and thank you, everyone out there in the audience. And it's my pleasure to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that we do day-to-day with our patients and some of the issues that come up. And to start, I'll build upon what Matt said a little bit, going back to the break concept. And I think the most exciting drugs that we have seen for our patients with lung cancer recently have been drugs that, again, take away this break on the immune system. And one way to think about this is that some tumors can put brakes onto the immune system to stop the immune system, your invading white blood cells, from attacking and killing the cancer. And these new drugs will release the brake, allowing those, the fighters of your immune system, to come in and to do what they're supposed to do, which is attack a cancer. So one question that comes up a lot in our clinic is, well, how is this different than chemotherapy? And there are several differences. I guess the primary difference is the target. So the target of chemotherapy is really the cancer cell or dividing cancer cell. And chemotherapies are, in a sense, a poison. And the thought here is that you want to poison the cancer more than the body. And things that are most susceptible to these poisons are cells that grow quickly, that divide and grow, and cancers, by definition, are things that grow faster than other parts of the body. So the idea here, again, is to poison the cancer more than the body. And the problem is that the side effects that you get are from the effects of the poison on the good parts of your body, whether that's hair loss or drops in your blood counts or nausea or problems with your gastrointestinal system. Immunotherapy, on the other hand, targets your own immune system, trying to boost your immune system's ability to attack cancer or take away the brake on the immune system, allowing it to do what it's supposed to do. So the toxicities are very different. As Matt pointed out, that some of the toxicities that you can have when you take away this brake would be what we call autoimmune toxicities, where your immune system is so ready to fight that it mistakenly attacks your own body. But that is quite rare, and when we do see that, it's generally very manageable. So one difference between chemotherapy and immunotherapy, and certainly the immune checkpoint inhibitors, the break, the therapies that take away the break on the immune system, is that the toxicities can be less, and also that if you do respond to one of these immunotherapies, the responses can be quite durable. Whereas chemotherapy, even if you do have tumor shrinkage, that effect might last a very short period of time. If you have a tumor shrinkage from immunotherapy, that last can sometimes go on for years, as the immune system can adapt with the tumor as it tries to avoid the immune system. So these are some of the major differences between immunotherapy and chemotherapy. In terms of administration, chemotherapy can be given intravenously or can be given orally. Same thing with immunotherapy, either by intravenous infusion or by pill, and then also by injections into the skin, such as vaccinations that you might get for the flu. So that really is those are the major differences, I would say, between chemotherapy and immunotherapy. Of course, we want to improve upon what we've seen so far, these sometimes dramatic responses that are prolonged in some of our patients, but we want to be able to treat patients who don't respond to these therapies by themselves. So Matt, myself, and Justin and others, we're looking at ways to combined immunotherapies with other therapies, whether with other immunotherapies or standard therapies for lung cancer, such as chemotherapy or radiation or other therapies that we might use for patients with lung cancer. Of course, we are trying to find out which patients are most likely to respond to which drug, and that will enable us to provide more effective treatments to those that need it and spare patients from therapy that's not going to work and that could be toxic. I was also asked to give you some examples of immunotherapy. I'm not sure if that means patient examples, but I will give you one patient of mine, her course. She started back about 5 years ago when we started evaluating these newer immunotherapies for our patients. And she had four prior lines of chemotherapy. She was already well into her cancer. And at that point, she was getting quite sick from her cancer, and her prognosis was poor, and because we were running out of options. At that point, we started her on an experimental therapy, and she responded clinically very quickly, and she continued on that therapy for 2 years as mandated by the trial, and then she had to stop, because the trial only said 2 years. And, of course, she and I were very concerned. But here we are 3 years later, and she has no evidence of active disease. This is a patient who had a prognosis, again, on the order of a few months back 5 years ago and now has no evidence of any active cancer. So she is truly the promise of immunotherapy, where we can see these durable responses in patients with excellent tolerability. She had very little in the way of side effects from her therapy. So it's not just her, of course. We've seen many patients now who have had durable responses, and this field is really becoming quite exciting because we've just seen a glimpse of what the immune system can do to attack and survey against cancer. So with that, I'll turn it over to Justin.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. Gettinger. That also is quite excellent and very, very really informative and also just very, again, very heartwarming to hear that the impact of immuno-oncology in the treatment of lung cancer. So thank you, and it's promise. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Justin Gaynor. Dr. Gaynor is instructor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, assistant in medicine, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Gaynor is going to address the role of clinical trials using immunotherapy in lung cancer, managing side effects, and questions to ask your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Gaynor.
Well, thank you for that introduction and for the invitation to speak today. As you can tell from Matt and Scott, this is clearly a very exciting time in the field of lung cancer treatment, one that's been marked by rapid progress. And I do want to emphasize that one of the ways that we've made such strides has actually been through rigorous clinical trials, trials that take a lot of effort, both on the part of the clinicians, but also very much the patients themselves who undergo these clinical trials to get access to some of these medications. Now, I'll begin by saying that the terms clinical trials can sometimes be scary for people. Instantly comes to mind some misconceptions that every study involves a placebo or they may not be getting the active medicine. And what I say is that clinical trials come in all different shapes and sizes. And today, lung cancer research is moving at such a lightning pace that sometimes the standard of care therapies may be therapies that one can access through a clinical trial. So I share the enthusiasm of my colleagues, the activity of some of these immunotherapy agents. They've shown great promise, but there are also still a lot of questions that remain. I'm excited to say that one of these drugs was actually recently FDA approved just about a month ago for a specific type of lung cancer called squamous cell lung cancer. And we're expecting that one of these medicines will also be approved for non-small cell lung cancer more generally in the coming months. So clearly an exciting time, but again, major questions remain, and the best way to answer such questions is really through clinical trials. One of the biggest questions in the field right now is, how do we identify people who are most likely to respond to these drugs? So even though they've shown great promise, and as Scott mentioned, the responses that we see have been quite durable, the truth of the matter is that a sizable percentage of patients don't respond to these drugs. And I'm specifically referring to a class of these immunotherapies called PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors. These are drugs that block the break. And so a major focus of research right now is trying to identify what it is about people who respond versus those who don't. And not just that, are there ways that we can try to improve the number of people who respond? And trying to use clinical trials to guide us towards either combinations, as Scott was mentioning, so either combining immunotherapy drugs with either vaccines, other immunotherapy drugs, or even standard chemotherapy or targeted therapies. So these are things that are best done in the context of a clinical trial where we get real strength in numbers and we can really collect the experience across the United States and really across the world and really getting strength in numbers. And the other things that we can investigate is not just, you know, what it is that drives people to respond to these drugs, but also why might these drugs stop working in some people? I think that is a question that will be on the horizon, and we have to be proactive in trying to answer things like that. Also, another major question is, right now, these drugs have shown benefit in the advanced disease setting, so once the cancer has spread outside of the lung. But can we use these active medicines earlier in the disease course? And apropos to Scott's example of where his patient was treated for 2 years and then came off therapy and has been disease-free for 3 years, the question is, how long do we have to treat patients for? Should we administer these drugs indefinitely, or should we stop after 2 years? I think these are all questions that are in the field, and the best way to answer them are really by trying to work as a team and conduct clinical trials. The one thing that we haven't mentioned is that, you know, I think the gas pedal brake analogy is an apt one, but the immune system is so complex that there's actually a series of gas pedals and a series of brakes. So future questions will also be, you know, which brake should we be applying, or should we combine one drug that releases one of the brakes and one drug that punches on the gas? So combinations may be a fruitful strategy, but again, we need to do this in the context of clinical trials. I'll just touch on briefly in terms of side effects to these medicines. I think Scott described this quite well. in that these are quite different than chemotherapy. Again, immunotherapy drugs aren't targeting the cancer itself. These are targeting your immune system and then relying on the immune system to try to combat the cancer. And so the types of side effects that we're seeing are really quite distinct from those seen with chemotherapy. In general, we're still waiting on some of the data from the studies that have already been conducted directly comparing chemotherapy versus these immunotherapy drugs. Many of those studies have already been completed, and we hope to have the data very soon. But it's my clinical sense in treating patients that these agents are very well tolerated. The most common side effects that people experience are things that such as fatigue, rash, or decreased appetite. And then very, very rarely people can have these so-called autoimmune side effects that Matt and Scott have both referenced. So this is when the immune system is so stimulated that it starts recognizing one's own body as foreign. Many times those can be treated. A relatively common autoimmune condition is just where the thyroid gland stops functioning as well. So those can be simply managed by prescribing a thyroid replacement. Far less common but potentially serious autoimmune problems can sometimes be treated with steroids, so agents that are intended to somewhat dampen the immune response just a little bit in order to avoid those toxicities. And then finally, in the last minute, I just wanted to touch on, what are some of the questions that if I were a patient that I might be asking my providers. And I think the first one would be, is something like an immunotherapy right for me? And if so, at what point in time? I think that's a big question that I would certainly ask my provider. And right now, many of these drugs are being given as part of a clinical trial. And so asking your provider, what are some of the benefits and risks of participating in a clinical trial? I think it's important to also ask your doctors about, what are the logistics of a clinical trial? And everyone's going to be a little different, and there are going to be different providers, different logistics at each institution, but the themes are the same. So, who will be monitoring me? How can I learn more about clinical trials? And who can I talk to if I have questions or concerns about a clinical trial? Those are all things that I would encourage you to talk to your doctors about. So with that, I think the second half is geared towards questions, and I welcome any questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Gaynor. That was really excellent, and again, just really very informative, and I think really very helpful for everyone to understand more about immuno-oncology and the treatment of lung cancer. And our next speaker is Wynn Burkle. Wynn is an oncology social worker. He's director of social service in the Long Island office and lung cancer program coordinator for cancer care. And Mr. Burkle is going to address cancer care's free psychosocial support services and programs and the role of support groups. Mr. Burkle?
Thanks, Carolyn. I'm sure most of us remember the time we moved into our first new home or even our last new home. And I'm sure we wondered how we were ever going to find our way in this new community or neighborhood. Many of us were fortunate enough to get a visit from the welcome wagon, or maybe a very helpful neighbor, who helped us find the nearest supermarket, service station, house of worship, school, and all the other services so essential to support our daily life. The more things we were able to connect to in our new neighborhood, the more we felt that we had things under control. Being diagnosed with lung cancer is, in some ways, very much like moving into a new neighborhood. Our cancer pushes us into a strange and sometimes scary new environment, and we really don't know where anything is and what we can do to get some control over a very difficult change in our lives. Cancer Care, in the role of that good neighbor, provides its popular website, lungcancer.org, to better serve people like you. Rather than burden folks with heavy medical jargon, CancerCareLungCancer.org has been designed as a first stop the people who find themselves in this new and strange neighborhood of lung cancer. Using simple-to-understand language in a user-friendly web page format, lungcancer.org helps patients and those who care for them learn about the basic facts on lung cancer and its treatment. And there is a special section on clinical trials, which not only helps one learn what they're all about, but also provides a special search tool which can assist in finding the lung cancer clinical trial that matches each patient's individual situation. And if a patient wishes to become involved in a clinical trial, there is a tool that allows them to connect with a specially trained clinical trials manager to help them with that whole process. In addition, lungcancer.org serves as an easy entrance to connect with the many services which Cancer Care has available free of charge for lung cancer patients and those who care for them. Such services include educational services, and Cancer Care's impressive array of Connect Education workshops provide both disease-specific information, such as today's workshop, and workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impact of cancer. Replays of these workshops are available both online at Cancer Care's website, www.cancercare.org, and via your phone. Many folks find it convenient to download these replays to their iPods and MP3 players. Cancer Care's well-known Cancer Care Connect booklets are available free of charge and are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help cancer patients and those who care for them. We're delighted to have distributed millions of these very popular publications. Cancer Care's website at www.cancercare.org provides a wealth of information on cancer topics and serves as an easy-to-use entry point to Cancer Care's many services. While one is at our website, they can sign up for our free monthly e-newsletter or catch up with our latest informative CopeLink blogs. Cancer Care offers helpful support services, which are provided by its professionally trained staff of experienced oncology social workers who are there to assist folks like you in dealing with the many issues which arise from the diagnosis of lung cancer, including assistance with emotional issues, in which they assess clients and provide appropriate, helpful psychosocial interventions, assistance with practical issues, such as financial assistance through Cancer Care's limited financial assistance program, and referrals to the Cancer Care Copay Assistance Foundation and other financial assistance resources, helpful with resource referral, in which our social workers refer folks to the many organizations and agencies established to help cancer patients. Navigating the system, Cancer Care social workers assist people in understanding how to best manage the many new relationships involved in healthcare and their communications, in which our workers are skilled at helping folks learn how to best communicate with their healthcare providers, employers, friends, and family members about this new situation. Cancer Care social workers provide this assistance in a variety of friendly settings, such as at Cancer Care's national office and its regional offices in the tri-state New York metropolitan area, where folks can receive individual and group counseling in a face-to-face venue, or over the phone, where people from across the nation can find immediate assistance by contacting the Cancer Care helpline at 1-800-813-HOPE, H-O-P-E. And for longer-term assistance through individual telephone counseling with a Cancer Care social worker, as well as connecting with other people in professionally facilitated telephone support groups, and, of course, online, where people from across the country share concerns in professionally-led online support groups, which are available 24/7 for participation. You know, our popular support groups, whether for patient or caregiver, and whether experienced in face-to-face, online, or telephone modalities, provide the group member with a safe place to share the burdens, feeling, and stress of the role of either a caregiver or patient who are involved in a very similar situation. There's never any need to explain yourself in a support group. They know what you're talking about. Group members share wonderfully helpful tips and information on how to best cope with their lung cancer situation. So many of our support group members talk about belonging to that special family which helps them live with lung cancer each day. The professional facilitative skills of Cancer Care's social workers ensure that each support group is maintained as a special place for each and every group member. Call us today to learn more about this wonderful free resource. You know, I'm sure none of us ever expected to find ourselves moved to the neighborhood of lung cancer. But now that you're here, be assured that Cancer Care, like that good neighbor, is there with you. Connect with us at www.cancercare.org or calling us at 1-800-813-HOPE. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Wynn, and thank you for really helping people to understand all the different services they can access for free from Cancer Care. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board and also to actually let the audience participants know how to queue up and ask questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. There are a lot of people on the call today. If we don't get to your question, then please call 1-800-813-4673 at the end of the call today, or as the weeks go by, if you have questions or concerns that come up. But for right now, let's see if we can take most of your calls right now. So, Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Rikla R. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, Rikla. What is your question?
Hi, the question is for Dr. Scott. I'm trying to find out, my sister has small lung cancer. I'm trying to find out what signs has immunotherapy worked with that type of cancer.
Well, thank you. I'm going to ask Dr. Gettinger if you could address that question in a general way. The question is about small cell lung cancer and about its treatment. Thank you.
So as some of you may know, that there's two general types of lung cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, which is the more common type, and then there's small cell lung cancer, also known as Hodgkin cell carcinoma. And most of the data for immunotherapies, at least for the new drugs that take away the break, are really for the non-small cell lung cancer. But the good news is that patients with small cell lung cancer are being enrolled to clinical trials evaluating similar drugs, and we should hear a little bit more about potentially promising results from these trials within the next month or not, a month or so. So I think for your sister, I believe you said, who has small cell lung cancer, if she is interested, I would encourage her to speak with her oncologist and to inquire about any small cell lung cancer trials that are ongoing, including any ones that are evaluating immunotherapies like these new break removers.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Excellent. And our next question?
Again, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone.
And we have some questions actually also from our online participants. And so we had a question from Janet. I wonder about Optivo, a new treatment for lung cancer. Side effects include pneumonia, and I'm wondering if this is an okay drug for my spouse with COPD and Parkinson's. Dr. Hellman, can you address that question in a general way, actually? And then we would actually encourage, of course, Janet to go back to her treating healthcare team.
Sure. Optivo is the medicine that that Justin had referenced was recently approved for squamous cell lung cancer just about a month ago, and that we suspect will, along with that or maybe other medicines in a short period of time, will be approved for probably all non-small cell lung cancer. The potential for side effects is an important consideration. And I think sometimes when we talk about the immune system and using that as a weapon against cancer, there's a presumption that it's intrinsically safe, that there's no problem. And although we hope that to be the case, and although I think most patients generally feel well on these medicines, there is the potential for side effects, like when the body's immune system does attack your own body instead of your cancer. And one of the places that can be particularly dangerous is when the body's immune system attacks the lungs, and what can be called pneumonitis, and when you have inflammation in the lungs rather than in your cancer. People can feel very short of breath, and things like steroids or other ways of suppressing the body's immune system are needed to try and treat the side effects. Unfortunately, although these side effects happen in a minority of people, they can happen. And unfortunately, we don't yet have a good tool to figure out who are people and most likely to develop these sort of side effects. We have treated a number of patients that have had things like COPD and emphysema to sort of reference the specific example. And it's not clear that that necessarily predisposes anybody to side effects, though they can occur in any patient. Other disease that people can have that that we've shied away from treating people with immunotherapy are patients that have autoimmune diseases, like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or lupus and so forth. These diseases where your body's immune system has already gone out of whack. For those patients, I generally don't recommend immunotherapy like Opdivo, but for patients with emphysema, which represents many patients with lung cancer, it would be a reasonable option.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And our next question, again, from one of our online participants. I want to know as much as possible about genomic profiling and new agents available, especially the checkpoint inhibitors. And Dr. Gettinger, can you address that question?
So genomic profiling refers to trying to fingerprint someone's tumor to understand what makes it tick. And this might lend itself to targeted therapies that specifically target the abnormalities that are found on genomic profiling. Right now, immune checkpoint inhibitors, the question being about them, these are not, there's no genomic profile that would predict per se who should get immune checkpoint inhibitors or not, and we are trying to figure out who is best suited to receive these therapies, but nothing yet in a genomic profile might determine that, other than if we saw a lot of abnormalities in the tumor that might lend itself to immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy. But right now those are separate, so if you do genomic profiling, you might find an abnormality that is very targetable. For example, something called EGFR or something called ALK or something called ROS, and there are many more, which are quite rare in lung cancer, but if you do find one of those abnormalities, there may be a pill that would be expected to shrink your tumor much better than chemotherapy would. Now, we are trying to understand those different groups of patients with lung cancer and see how the immune checkpoint inhibitors fit into them. But right now, we're not entirely sure how best to use those drugs in patients who have these special abnormalities where there's a very good targeted oral therapy available.
Excellent. Thank you. And anyone else want to comment? Excellent. Great questions and really fantastic questions, and also wonderful speakers as well in terms of addressing these questions. We have some questions really about lung cancer and smoking, actually. So I'm going to ask, Wynn, if you would address this question that has to do with the stigma of lung cancer and its association with sometimes smoking. If you could comment just on the personal experiences that many people have and report in the group, I think that might be very helpful to one of our online members and perhaps others in the group as well. Wynn, if you could address that.
From the perspective of a support group, people are reluctant to join a support group because they feel that they are personally stigmatized by having smoked and then having been diagnosed with lung cancer. What's interesting is that when people join the group, they soon find out that smoking is really not an issue, because in the group, it turns out that the ethos is really, it doesn't matter whether you smoked most of your life, whether you never smoked, or whether you smoked right up until the time of diagnosis. It's not about smoking, okay? It's about coming together to learn how to live each day with lung cancer and to not let lung cancer become the thing that manages your life. So it's interesting that kind of smoking and your smoking history is left outside the door. Certainly, it does come up that oftentimes people in the support group will say that unless it's a medical professional, to be asked by someone, did you smoke? okay, is a very insulting and obnoxious question for them to deal with, and they say that represents the stigma that exists out there. Unfortunately, the stigma of lung cancer can exist on three levels, and the first level is in society, where very often, unfortunately, people make the assumption that, well, if lung cancer, well, you must have smoked, or if you had been a smoker, one of the things that will come up sometimes is there'll be a stigma within the family where there'll be expressions of, if you had loved me, okay, you would have stopped smoking when I asked you to, and now we're bankrupt paying for your treatments. The third level is oftentimes the patients themselves, there's sort of a nihilistic attitude of, well, I smoked, so I'm not even going to bother with treatment anymore. It's unfortunate that there are so many other diseases that arise from smoking where that stigma doesn't exist. So it's important, okay, for lung cancer patients, caregivers, to be somewhat assertive and say that smoking, okay, is not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a serious disease, and that's what we're really going to focus our efforts and energies on.
Thank you. Thanks so much. We have another question from Stuart, one of our online participants. So question is about drugs that treat non-small cell lung cancers. Status of FDA approval, what is their effectiveness? Dr. Gaynor, would you like to address that question generally in terms of just the treatments available? And that's kind of probably
sure.
A large question.
Sure. Yeah, so you it's a good question. So in general, we think of treating lung cancer with what we call systemic agents, so drugs that enter the bloodstream that go everywhere where the blood goes. The kind of the standard of care has been for decades now using chemotherapy for the treatment of lung cancer. However, beginning about 10 years ago, researchers identified that certain people with lung cancer can have certain genetic mutations or alterations in their DNA of the cancer that can allow us to use targeted pill-based therapies, liken them to a lock and a key. So they're specific to a mutation, and those agents can be very effective. That's what Dr. Gettinger was alluding to when he mentioned that there are these subsets of genes called EGFR or ALK and ROS1. So right now, there are several drugs, three drugs approved, three of these targeted drugs, or two in the United States, I should say, to treat the EGFR. There are two that are approved to treat ALK. One of them is approved. One of those drugs also treats ROS. In terms of immunotherapies, which is what we've been talking about for this conference, the one drug that has been approved is an agent called Opdivo, or also goes by the name of nivolumab. And that was recently FDA approved 4 weeks ago for treatment of squamous cell lung cancer, although our hope is that and expectation is that that will likely be approved more broadly. There are other agents, other immunotherapies that have been granted breakthrough therapy status by the U.S. FDA, meaning that they're on this fast track towards approval. One of those drugs has already been approved for a form of skin cancer, melanoma. And so our hope is that, you know, these agents will also are on the horizon and our patients will have access to them shortly.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question similar to this, from Jorge, what is the main difference between Opdivo and pembrolizumab? Can they be used in the same type of patients, and when is pembrolizumab expected to get approval? Dr. Hellman, could you address that question?
I think these are both medicines that target something called PD-1. As far as we know, that they're largely similar and maybe largely the same. the nivolumab has been approved for squamous lung cancer. I think it is expected that pembrolizumab will also be approved for non-small cell lung cancer, perhaps as early as this calendar year, but it's hard to know. I would think of both medicines as being largely the same.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question from another one of our online participants. Does taking large doses of antioxidants, vitamin E, prevent lung cancer? Dr. Gettinger, would you like to address that question again in a general way? And, of course, and we do want everyone to work with their treating healthcare team as well, but if there were some just general guidelines, Dr. Gettinger, that you could provide on this.
I would say that at this point, there's nothing that you can clearly take to decrease your chances of getting lung cancer, whether it's an antioxidant, which clearly can have beneficial value for some patients, or some other therapy. The best thing you can do to decrease the chance of you developing lung cancer would be to stop smoking if you are a smoker. And then in patients who have had a good amount of smoking in their past, we've started to do screening low-dose radiation CAT scans for patients to try to pick up a cancer before it's causing problems and at a time where you can still give a curative therapy. There have been many trials that have looked at all sorts of agents that have tried to decrease the chance of a lung cancer recurrence or the development of initial lung cancer, but none of them have clearly shown a benefit from any particular agent at this point. But we still are looking into this.
And could you also talk about the concept of taking, I know a lot of people will take various, I guess, antioxidants or vitamins or supplements during their treatment and the need to right. work with their healthcare team so that everyone's on board with what everyone's taking and just to be sure it doesn't interact with the synergistic effect of everything. You could just comment on that. That often comes up on the calls.
Sure. That comes up a lot in the clinic as well, where patients are taking several different herbal medications, and which we don't know too much about. You know, certainly there's anecdote that some of these herbal medications can be helpful, whether it is for cancer or for side effects. But unfortunately, we have our blinders on, and we need to be shown clear evidence that something benefits a patient in a large clinical trial. So those trials don't really exist for most of those drugs. Our main concern when a patient presents with a list of many different herbal medications is could any of these agents interfere with chemotherapy or targeted therapy or immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy, because we know that those therapies have clearly established a benefit for patients being treated, and we don't want to compromise that benefit. And this is difficult, and, you know, sometimes, you know, we don't know the answers, and because no one really understands if there is a drug-drug interaction. And the best that we can do sometimes is say, in moderation, you don't want to be taking very high doses of any particular supplement, because that has a higher chance of interfering with the therapies that are approved for patients' lung cancer. We will need to address this more and more as the years go on, because I think an increasing number of patients are being evaluated by holistic doctors and getting these very complicated and expensive recommendations for these different therapies, which, you know, it's the data isn't so clear yet. So that's what we generally go through in clinic a lot, and we usually come up with a compromise.
Excellent. Thank you. Excellent. And so the last question that we'll be taking is from Charles, and it says, how can I prepare for my upcoming summer vacation and my ongoing treatment? And I'm going to ask if everyone would just weigh in on that, because indeed the weather, indeed, of course, people are in different parts of the world and actually different climates, it is true, but in this upcoming months. People are asking really, how can I prepare for vacations and also on my ongoing treatment? How do I work with my team on that? So Dr. Hellman, if you would start, and then Dr. Gettinger, Dr. Gaynor, and Wynn Burkle as well.
I'm not certain exactly what sort of meant. I'll take it from the context of how does one approach vacations and how do you sort of integrate your treatment with the rest of your life? I think it's important to to realize that the goal of our treatment is to help patients live better and longer. And that includes allowing you to be able to do the things that are important to you, like taking time with your family, taking time to go on vacation and so forth. And as best as possible, I think the treatment should move around those things. If you are safe to travel and to take vacation, you should do it. As best as possible, I'd encourage patients and the providers to try and work around those important things so that you can be an important participant in your life and the life of your family. And so I would encourage people to go on vacation if they have things planned. But talk to your doctors about how best to schedule things as best as possible so that you can enjoy things stress-free. In the context of immunotherapy in particular, these medicines last a long time. They last in your body a long time. And so if treatments are delayed for a week or more, I wouldn't stress too much about it. I think that the medicines do probably last for many weeks, if not months.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Gettinger?
Well, I agree with Matt, and I think it's important that the patient meets with his or her oncologist and discusses their concerns, and specifically what they want to do. So if they want to go away for 3 to 4 weeks to go on a camping trip, we, as oncologists, we will work around that, and we will figure out a way to make that happen in most cases. Very rarely will there be a time where we can't come up with some plan that it works out for the patient as well as for the treating team. And in terms of the immunotherapy, I completely agree with Matt that, you know, we have certainly given a patient a week or two delay in order for them to get the most out of their vacation. But there is some wiggle room in terms of the therapies that we give, whether they're immunotherapy or not. And the goal here is to maximize quality of life, and that includes a good vacation.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Gaynor?
I think that was perfectly said by Dr. Hellman and Dr. Gettinger. I think, you know, at the core of what we do is making sure that patients have good quality of life as well. And so I would just encourage speak to your doctor. We certainly accommodate where we can as long as it's safe, and can certainly modify things where we need to. And so I would just encourage the person to reach out to their clinician, and I'm sure their clinician would be accommodating as well.
And Wynn, do you want to add anything as well?
Yeah, in our lung cancer support groups, vacations are often the subject because it's important, and there's an encouragement to take vacations. But I always remember this one woman in our lung cancer support group who said that when I take a vacation, she said, I usually fly, and she said, when I fly, I always make sure I get a ticket for a seat by the window. And everybody said, well, why is that? She said, because once that plane takes off, she said, I look down there, and I look back at the city, and I look back at the hospital, and she says, I'm leaving my cancer there for this vacation. So that's what vacations are all about.
Excellent. Wow. Well, this was an amazing call, I have to say. I really want to thank all of our speakers for just being phenomenal, and I want to thank all of you who've asked such great questions, and also those of you who've been listening as well. And I hope that you will take this information back to your treating healthcare team, that this will be useful to you in your discussions. It will help you to ask more informed questions. I also want to remind you that if you didn't get to ask a question, please call us at 1-800-813-4673. And remember, we do have a full staff of oncology social workers who are here to provide a host of services, and they're all free, from practical and financial assistance to counseling, someone to talk to, support groups both on the telephone and online, these workshops, and indeed there is a part two of this workshop, which is managing the side effects of immuno-oncology and the treatment of lung cancer, which occurs on June 9th. And we have lots of publications and a very active website. So as we conclude the call, please, I know many of you often feel alone in coping with lung cancer or in coping with cancer in general. Please know that you are now a part of the cancer care world, and that you can contact us in those moments when you need to speak to someone, and even sometimes just in preparation for those moments, that we're here for you as a support. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.